This is a special edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk with Frayne Olson from North Dakota State University Extension. He serves as an agricultural economist at NDSU. It's a conversation I held with him in mid-February. First, I'd like to remind you that coming up on the 5th day of March, that's a Tuesday, not very far away now, you can join us and the Farm Doc team, the agricultural analyst that you hear on WILL and willag.org at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana, for the All Day Ag Outlook. This is a magnificent event, and if you've not ever been, you should sign up today. The cost is just $40. That includes your Beef House meal at the noon hour and a cinnamon roll and coffee from the Beef House in the morning. And throughout the day, you'll hear from our brokers and analysts in the soybean panel and the corn panel. We'll wrap up near the 3 o'clock hour if you're in the Illinois time zone, 4 o'clock in Indiana. That's the end of the day. We'll be done by those times when we'll talk with Bruce Sherrick in that last segment. He'll discuss the future of farmland prices across the region. And as we move through the day, we'll hear about the weather forecast with Eric Snodgrass and SAF with Phil Ansell. He's the director at the Center for Sustainable Aviation here on the University of Illinois campus. We'll talk about crop insurance and kinds of decisions that producers need to make by the 15th of March, as it's related to that, how much they really should take and what kinds of crop insurance might be best, as it's related to ECO and SCO, if those are options people are considering. And on that front, how the Arkin PLC decision will be made. We'll also get an update on crops in Brazil from Joanna Colucci, and hear the grain outlook and budgets for the state of Illinois from Joe Jansen. It will be a fantastic day. I hope you will join the Farm Doc team, myself, the Will Ag analyst, all at the Beef House on Tuesday, the 5th day of March. You can't be there unless you get yourself registered. Do that right now at willag.org or at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. Frayne Olson now joins us from North Dakota State University. He's at NDSU in Fargo. Hi, well, thanks for being with us, Frayne. I'd like to start with a conversation that you and I had maybe in 2016, could have been as late as 2017, though I don't know that the timing matters so much at this point. At that point in time, there was a seasonality to soybean pricing in the state, which meant that if farmers were to harvest the soybeans, not have anything really marketed, and just waited, that they would see a dollar appreciation in the basis, meaning basis would jump a dollar compared to the futures market. And I'm wondering if that's still the case.
So yes and no. We still do have a pretty strong seasonal pattern. We tend to see the lows of the basis levels right at harvest, obviously, because that's the highest inflow of grain. And one of the things that a lot of historically about 70% of the soybeans grown in this region end up going to export out of the PNW. And so we're very, very export dominant. And when you look at the seasonal patterns for U.S. soybean exports, you know, when, at what time of year do we ship soybeans, whether it be out of the Gulf or whether it be out of PNW, that has a very, very strong seasonal pattern, and so our basis levels follow that. A lot of the elevators in the region, understanding this basis pattern, have also tried to book freight because most of it goes out on a shuttle train out to the PNW, and we have large volumes coming in right at harvest. And so as a farm manager, if you're forward pricing, trying to forward price for, let's say, mid-season for delivery at harvest, you can get some pretty good basis levels. But if you haven't priced anything, by the time you hit that harvest market, you know, there is quite a significant depreciation or dropping of the basis levels to incentivize at least putting some of that grain in the bin and then pulling it out later to be able to manage the flow of product. And so, yes, as we get out of that harvest season, as we find a home for all of the bushels, we tend to have a pretty nice, significant, steady increase in the basis to try and, again, incentivize moving that grain back out of the bin and into the supply chains because of that tight window. And usually by the time we get into this whole early to mid-February time period, our basis levels are starting to drop off again because that export market out of the PNW specifically is starting to slow. It's not that you can't make some better sales if there's a recovery in the futures market, but if you're playing the basis game, that seasonal basis pattern has been very, very strong in the past. Now, moving forward, some of that is starting to change. As we get more crush capacity up here in the Northern Plains, the crushers, just like an ethanol plant, obviously need to have product flowing in on a continuous basis year-round. And so what we're seeing is because of the crush demand and the fact that they need to have product flowing on a continual basis, we're starting to see that basis pattern shifting. The pattern is still there, but the highs aren't quite as high and the lows aren't quite as low. So we're seeing more of a stability occurring. So the timing of the pattern hasn't shifted, but the kind of the amplitude or the highs and lows aren't as broad as we said, as we've seen before, because again, the local demand is trying to make sure that they capture a portion of that product flow. So again, the pattern is there, but not as exaggerated as what we've seen in the past.
I do want to talk as well about just farmer marketing, and maybe more broadly, this is likely to include corn. When soybeans broke through $12 and corn had been drifting for a long time, I think that was the seventh week in a row for both that they had closed lower. That $12 area just seemed, while it was a 15-cent drop on that Friday, psychologically felt almost disastrous because you were hopeful, or the market, the farmers, were hopeful that soybeans could manage to lift the marketplace, and it took the wind out of the sails. And things changed as well because, there are bills due on March 1, and a lot of pressure came into the marketplace. I think it went from worry to possibly a little panic. Did that happen in your part of the world?
Yes, definitely. I've had a pretty heavy travel schedule over the last couple of months, so I've had a lot of face-to-face meetings with farmers, and I could certainly sense that anxiety level starting to increase pretty rapidly. And over the last couple of weeks, it's especially on corn, but even on soybeans now, it's gotten to a point where people are getting very nervous. And the concern, and this is, I know not only myself, but other marketing analysts have been talking about watching the South American weather, what's the size of the South American crop for both soybeans and corn. You know, we've had some challenges and issues show up in the Brazilian crop, in particular for soybeans, which is usually one of those triggers where if we start seeing some problems there, we start to see some lift or some turning points, if you will, within the U.S. markets. And this year, we just really haven't seen that. And what I'm trying to do is caution people is yes, we're having some challenges. There are some issues showing up in the South American crop. That's obviously changing some of the mentality. But those have not really turned into or translated into U.S. export sales. And historically, if there was a problem, again, in South America, the challenge was, well, if they can't buy it from South America, there will likely be some international buyers, China particularly, but also other international buyers that will come in and try and get some short-term coverage. They were planning to buy out of the South American crop. If it's not as large as they think it's going to be, they come back to the U.S. and buy some more from the U.S. to make sure that they have their product flow that they need. And that's also one of the things, as we've talked about with logistics and ocean freight and transportation and being able to get vessels delivered on time, there was this concern, well, if there are going to be this supply chain disruptions, will they come to the U.S.? Will international buyers come to the U.S. and buy some more to be able to take that coverage? And so far, we just haven't seen it. And even though we've had some positive news show up in the market, it just hasn't had that impact on the futures market. So we continue to see this drifting lower. And in my view, from my perspective, I guess that has been one of my trigger points, one of the things that I have been looking for very closely to say, are these lower prices at a level now where the U.S. is not only competitive relative to other suppliers, but also then that we can deliver on time. And so that these international buyers come in and buy U.S. product, not necessarily deferring their purchases or delaying those purchases, waiting for some other supplier. So that is one of those not only psychological triggers, but also one of those fundamental triggers that I'm watching for. So when will these lower prices actually translate into export sales? And those, in my opinion, for corn in particular, but also for soybeans, will be that thing that I'm watching for very, very closely. And hopefully that will give us, in this turning point, we'll get the low in the market, and we'll have at least a partial rebound to be able to move some more grain through the system.
So why haven't they, to the point that you and I are talking on this Tuesday, the 13th day of February, why haven't they at this point reached that level yet? Is it just that there's enough?
Okay. Yeah, and part of that, I do think part of that has been the carryover from, or the supplies from last year's production. So last year, when you look at Argentina, had some significant problems. So again, that third year of basically continuous drought. This year, obviously, that drought has been broken. They're having a much better crop. But last year, Brazil had this monster soybean crop, and they had a very, very strong corn crop, which meant that their export season, they were able to extend that with old crop sales. So that shortened the window for U.S. export markets. And yes, we have been filling the gap in some particular countries. We've been able to fill that. But because of the aggressive sales, and I do think that international buyers then have been purchasing for delivery later in the season to get that coverage level. So they're buying more aggressively. They're buying further into the future, which means now those deliveries are coming up shortly. So as we get into now this harvest season for South America again, in particular for soybeans, that gap, that window between when old crop was basically sold out versus when the new crop inventory is hitting the marketplace is relatively short, particularly for soybeans, but even for corn. And so that gap that we as the United States typically fill in between there is narrow enough that, you know, they're not being that aggressive. They're not terribly concerned or worried about the deliveries for that new crop grain yet. So, well, again, I'm waiting to see if that attitude changes and see if we do get some U.S. picks up some more export sales.
Kudos to our regular Wednesday analyst, Greg Johnson from TGM of Total Grain Marketing. As we were going through August into September, all the way into October, we talked about that gap not being there or not being as big, so that they had extended the South American export season right into the U.S. harvest season or deeper into it. And I guess on the back end then, if we get the harvest have gotten the harvest out of both Argentina and Brazil, that just the length of time which was available for exports out of the United States meant that we exported fewer bushels and that our export ability remains very high, but that the price just hasn't allowed that to happen. And is some of that logistics simply on the way the market works to move and allocate the ships that are available to move grain?
There is some of that, yes. So one of the things from a logistics standpoint we're watching, of course, is when we think about the movement of grain, we really need to think about the supply of bulk ocean freight. So it's those ships that are designed to haul bulk freight. And that includes grain, but it also includes things like iron ore or coal or other bulk products, right? So the grain complex, just like using rail transportation, has to compete against these other uses for the same kind of vessels. Well, with the challenges we're facing now in the Red Sea, where some of those vessels that are hauling grain as well as other products, instead of going through the Red Sea and going through the Indian Ocean, which is kind of a shortcut for a lot of the Black Sea wheat, as well as some of the Black Sea corn, as well as some of the European grains, those vessels are now having to go around the southern tip of Africa. And so that's adding about 2 weeks to the transit times. And it's just like having, you know, truck drivers in the middle of harvest. Well, if they have construction zone, they got to go around and reroute past the construction zone. It slows up the whole system. Okay, so it's part of it is the cost is going up, but part of it is also the time, the turnaround time to be able to get those, that vessel from where it's being loaded to where it needs to be unloaded, in particular into those Asian markets. And so the question has been, well, if there are some delivery shortfalls or if there's some time delays, is it possible that people will come in and international buyers will come in and buy some more U.S. products, because in particular out of the PNW, because of that whole shorter haul or that shorter distance going from the PNW ports back into the Asian markets. And again, we just have not seen that happen yet. So it seems as though the supply chain is working well enough that the end users are getting what they need. Again, that might change very quickly, but it right now we just haven't seen it. It hasn't translated into those sales that we're really looking for.
It, because China is the largest user of soybeans on the planet, taking the primary bulk of the exports from the United States, I believe also from China, from Brazil. Mm-hmm. How much does what we're seeing have to do with their economy?
Actually, a relatively large portion, in my opinion. So if you look at some long-term trends, you know, in particular for soybeans, it's most dramatic for soybeans. When you look at the volume of soybean imports and the rate of change, how quickly has that demand base for soybeans into China, has that grown over time? It's been almost a straight line for 15, almost 20 years. But over about the last 5 years or so, it's still increasing, right? The amount they're buying is still increasing, but that rate of change, that growth rate has really started to slow. It's starting to kind of flatten out. Now, I do think it'll continue to expand. It's just not going to be at the rate that we've seen for, you know, for the last 15 or 20 years. And there's two pieces to that. Part of it is, yes, their economy is not growing as quickly, which, again, as your economy gets bigger, your rate of growth starts to slow. It's just harder to add, you know, double-digit growth on a very, very large number. But the other challenge they're running into is they do have this population problem. They also have some of the worker challenges or employment challenges, the workforce issues that we do here in the U.S. And when you have those workforce issues, your economy starts to slow. Well, combine a slower growth in your economy with a livestock sector, in particular hogs, that's also not growing as fast. They're battling some challenges with African swine fever. Even though it's better now, it's still not completely under control. They have changed some of their production systems. They have changed some of their feeding programs. They still need a large volume of soybean and soybean meal, but that growth rate has slowed, okay? But the growth rate in production out of Brazil and Argentina, primarily out of Brazil, has really not slowed yet. And so when we think about that differential, the amount of soybeans that need to be purchased from the United States relative up to other sources, you know, that just even the volumes are starting to drop. So it's not only a seasonality problem. You have the large crop from last year that shortens our export window, but just the fact that in particular Brazil is able to supply larger volumes than they have in the past makes a difference. So yes, some of this is a longer term, not necessarily short term, but longer term. Some of that is the growth rate in the Chinese economy and the growth rate then in their livestock sector, primarily in pork, but also in poultry.
I have two other questions, one on corn and one on soybeans, but I do want to come to corn before I get to the soybean question.
Sure.
On corn, as we talked about earlier, the exports were what you were hoping and looking for to see, to find a bottom, a place to get a lift out of the marketplace. That safrinha or second crop corn in Brazil is just going into the ground, so there's a lot of time yet there. Are there other reasons, for instance, why Mexico's maybe not in the marketplace as large? And can you see those exports picking up at some point? And does that happen in the middle of the planting season? And how problematic is that?
Boy, a lot of pieces to unpack there.
Right.
So when we think about, you know, who are the large buyers of U.S. corn?
And traditionally, Mexico has been our number one customer. Okay, and when we look at the trends for Mexican buying for U.S. corn, that we have seen a growth rate. Now, last year we were off a little bit, primarily because they had a larger crop, they had a better production season last year, and also our corn prices are much higher. Now, this year, the opposite is happening. The Mexicans had a shorter corn crop. Their crop wasn't as large. They had some pretty large crop areas in the core corn-producing region, so they need to purchase more corn. But also now our corn prices are lower. So if you look at the demand base out of Mexico, that's actually, and that's one of the reasons we're having a reasonably good export season right now, is because of that Mexican. When we look at some of our other core buyers, corn, like Japan, some going into Europe, some going to some of the South Asian countries, again, those are relatively stable markets for us. And the price is high or price is low, they buy about the same amount every year. The swing vote for our export sales has always been China. When they have a growing demand base, or if they have their corn crop isn't as large as they thought it was going to be, or they have some production issues, they can come into the global market in kind of a big way. And that's always kind of our swing vote. If we have a really good export system, it's because not only are we selling to our traditional customers, we add that demand base. Well, this last year, China's corn production was pretty good. And so China is the second largest corn producer in the world. The United States is the largest when it comes to total bushels produced, but China's number two. Okay, so they had a pretty good corn crop. They did have some quality issues, okay, but the total volumes available are very strong. And then you add on to that, again, pretty good corn crop from last year in Brazil. And that's one of the reasons we're having a little bit softer. Okay, so moving forward, you're absolutely right. The safrinha crop is the larger of the two corn crops. We also have to remember that the safrinha crop is primarily grown in the north, and they do have some logistical challenges in the corn if it's grown in the northern regions to a port facility. They can do it. There's some of that corn is exportable stocks. A larger portion of the corn that's exportable that can easily hit the international market is actually the first crop corn, which will be starting harvest now relatively soon. So from a buyer standpoint, they're saying, well, when will that first crop corn start hitting the market? It's much closer to their major export terminal. It's much easier to get it filled onto an ocean-going vessel. Are there things moving forward that can change that? The size of the safrinha crop is important just because it is such a dominant production time period. They're in the process of planting right now. Planting progress is a little bit ahead of normal. They've had some rain showers to be able to get enough soil moisture to get the crop in the ground and the crop growing. But they have not had enough rain to recharge their subsoil moisture yet. And so the corn crop is looking okay right now, but there is this concern, you know, they're going to be living kind of rain shower to rain shower until they make sure that they have the production they need. So there are some things happening in the safrinha crop that could change people's attitudes, that could shift more of that demand base to the United States. The other obviously key question that we're going to be talking about very, very shortly is, what do we do with corn plantings here in the U.S.? And what kind of crop conditions we can have, which is our normal kind of thought process and how many bushels are going to be filled. So the safrinha crop is going to be a little bit ahead of the U.S. crop, usually about 1 to 2 months sooner than we will be here in the U.S. So again, there will be some things we're going to be watching. The key is, will that actually translate into export sales and purchases?
And finally, the last question is about capacity, domestic use capacity in the Northwest Corn Belt in particular. Both related to corn and soybeans, because I think we have to talk about SAF at some point. I don't think that's a big deal at this point, but you probably have some thoughts about it, sustainable aviation fuel. And then, of course, renewable diesel and crushing plants in your area. Those are coming up. Do you think that capacity will all be built?
So we have one plant that is now operational. It's a joint venture between ADM and Marathon Oil. For the soybean oil coming out of that facility, it's all going into renewable diesel. That's been announced. It's part of the plan. So that is operational right now. That was a facility that was actually converted from an old malting barley plant. So they bought the facilities, they retrofitted it, basically gutted it, and then rebuilt it. We have a second plant under construction right now. It's supposed to be operational by harvest of 2024. And from everything I'm hearing, that they're still on track for that. There's a third plant that has been proposed. They're still working on some of their financing packages. We'll wait to see. We're going to have to defer to see if that one is actually built or not. Again, it's a little bit earlier in the stages right now, in the development stages. So we do have two very large commercial-sized crushing plants that are going to be, one of them is operating, one of them is coming online soon. And that will have, both of those will have the capacity to chew up a lot of the soybeans that we produce in this region, especially here in the kind of this Northern Plains area. Again, that will have an impact on not only cropping plans, but also have an impact, obviously, on basis and pricing levels, which we talked about earlier. This is the timing. So the timing of this, because I also get this question. So, how big of an impact will this have nationally? And it's really, in my view, a matter of timing. Okay, so when we think about the size of the U.S. domestic crush industry right now, soybean crushing specifically, and yes, we are adding some new plants here in the northern regions, but on a percentage basis, that's a relatively small increase in a very large number. And there is this additional growth capacity. Look at the growth of the amount of soybeans going into U.S. crush. That's been slowly growing over the last 10 years. So will that growth rate start to increase because of renewable diesel? Well, maybe. But you also got to understand either retrofitting or expanding an existing facility, or more importantly, putting a brand new facility is exceptionally expensive. The press releases we've seen for the two plants up in this region, it costs between, $350 to $450 million to put up one of those facilities today. That's a lot of money. That's a major commitment by any kind of company to be able to put up a brand new greenfield facility. So will we see continued expansion? I do expect that, but I think it's going to be more at a steady pace. It's not going to be like the growth rate that we saw in the ethanol industry, where we went from almost nothing to almost 40% of our corn grown through an ethanol system. Right now, we already have almost 50% of our soybeans going into a crush plant to start with. So we have that really big base of capacity to begin with. Will it grow? I do expect it to do that. The question is how quickly. Same thing for SAF, the sustainable aviation fuel. Now, my understanding, and I'm not a chemist, but my understanding is that you still have to take the ethanol and process it one more time to actually get it into the sustainable aviation fuel process. So, yes, we have a lot of processing capacity for base ethanol right now. But the question is how quickly will that final step from ethanol into aviation fuel, how long will that take to be able to build the capacity required? And I know there's a lot of interest from the aviation industry in getting that done, but it's also about the dollars it takes to build that infrastructure to be able to not only process it, but also then be able to get it delivered to the right place. And that, I think, will take time. It's not something that's going to happen overnight. So I think there's some optimism, but this is going to be a few years down the road before we start to see it in the marketplace to the level that I think a lot of farmers are thinking. So it's a matter of timing.
Hey, thank you much. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure visiting.
Frayne Olson is an agricultural economist at North Dakota State University Extension in Fargo. I spoke with him in mid-February. Coming up in the beginning of March, on Tuesday, the fifth day of that month, by the way, I hope that you'll join us at the All Day Ag Outlook at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. You know the drill. You can sign up today at willag.org, willag.org. The cost is just $40, and that includes your Beef House lunch. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.